Hey everyone, it's Nate here, host of the Vinyl Guide podcast, and right now it's Monday, June 10th, 2019 in Australia, and what you're about to hear is a fully produced episode of the Vinyl Guide featuring an interview with Willie D of the Ghetto Boys. Now this conversation happened several months ago before news of Willie D's former bandmate and Ghetto Boy Bushwick Bill went public that he was suffering from stage 4 pancreatic cancer. Whether Willie D knew about it at the time or not, this wasn't the subject of our conversation, which you'll hear today. What Willie D and I did was speak about the Ghetto Boys, the controversies, the records, the behind-the-scenes stories, and lots more. Now, this episode had been fully produced and ready to go, and then, as of this morning, a few hours before it was due to be released, word came out that Bushwick Bill had died from pancreatic cancer. Then word came back that he wasn't dead, but in critical condition. So either way, it's bad news for Ghetto Boys fans around the world. Bushwick was a critical member of the Ghetto Boys, and our thoughts and positive vibes go to Bushwick Bill and his family and friends. Now, as far as today's episode, I've made the decision to go forward with the episode as it was produced in full. However, there's going to be no advertisements other than a request for all of you to consider donating to your local cancer charities. Finding a cure for cancer is not the role of the government, or if it is, they sure as hell aren't doing it. It's up to scientists to make breakthroughs in cancer research, and they need your help to support their causes. Wherever you are in the world, please consider a donation to a pancreatic cancer foundation. Other people you may know of who have died of pancreatic cancer include Apple co-founder Steve Jobs, comedian Bill Hicks, Sharon Jones of Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, Greg Lake of Emerson, Lake & Palmer, Benjamin Orr of The Cars, and the list goes on. Look, let's find a cure for cancer, sign up for a charity walk, donate some cash, do whatever you can do to help find a cure. Fuck cancer. And now, the Vinyl Guide episode featuring Willie D of the Ghetto Boys.
It's Willie D, y'all. Ghetto Boys in the building. Right now, you're tuned in to the Vinyl Guide with Nate Goya. Don't say I didn't warn you.
Well, hey, everyone. It's Nate from the Vinyl Guide. And I got to say, today's episode, I am so stoked about. We don't get a lot of rap artists here on the Vinyl Guide. Not because I'm not trying. Look, in the past, we've had a couple of the greats on the show, including Daryl DMC McDaniels, episode number 101. And of course, Royce Da5'9 joined us on episode number 149. And today, I'm very pleased to be adding yet another hip-hop legend to that Mount Rushmore of interviews we've had here on the Vinyl Guide. Today, we are speaking with Willie D, best known as rapper and lead writer from the Ghetto Boys. And I must be clear, I've been a huge fan of the Ghetto Boys for years. Their records are amongst my favorite hip-hop albums. They're shocking, they're hilarious, they're well-constructed, and their self-titled LP holds up to this very day. And when I started this podcast, one of my initial signs of success was to get one of the Ghetto Boys here on the show. I had so many questions, and I'm very pleased to share that in the interview you're about to hear, I got those questions answered and a whole lot more. Now, for those of you who know about the Ghetto Boys and are familiar with their music, you're probably overexcited, already fast-forwarding to the interview now, which is fine. However, for those of you who aren't as familiar, here's a brief history of the band that may be helpful going into the interview. The Ghetto Boys hip-hop group was formed in the late 1980s in Fifth Ward, Texas, one of the rougher neighborhoods of Houston. And after a couple of releases on Rap-A-Lot Records, the Ghetto Boys were then discovered by Rick Rubin, who wanted to put them out on his then newly created Def American Records. The Ghetto Boys and Rick Rubin got straight to work, and when the self-titled album came out on Def American, only a year and change after NWA's Straight Outta Compton, the Ghetto Boys LP came under such fire for the content, the lyrics, the stories that Willie D and team were rapping about, that Sony, who were contracted to make the CDs and the album, flatly refused to have anything to do with the Ghetto Boys and stopped manufacturing of any further Ghetto Boys albums. This thing came to a head and Geffen Records dissolved its distribution agreement with Def American. Amazingly, a manufacturing company refused to press CDs purely due to the content. And on top of it, very few vinyl LPs of the Geto Boys' debut were pressed. If you could find them now, they're quite expensive, into the triple digits in decent shape. Now, this is a huge error, ultimately for Geffen, who missed out on other top-selling Deaf American releases after that, including The Black Crows, Slayer, Sir Mix-a-Lot, and heaps more. Now, keep in mind, all this controversy was caused by the words coming out of the mouth and the mind of the guy we're going to talk to today. In the interview, Willie D gets straight into it. It's a deep, no-holds-barred discussion. Willie discusses growing up in a tough environment, connecting with Rap-A-Lot Records, joining the Geto Boys, working with Bushwick Bill, Scarface, and of course the late, great DJ Ready Red. Where the Geto Boys sound came from, the controversial Steve Miller sample from Gangster of Love, the album cover of We Can't Be Stopped, and heaps more. Enjoy the episode today, and make sure to give Willie D some love, attention, and dollars, and download his latest track at willied.com. So before we get into the interview, I do want to share in other Geto Boys news, it was recently revealed that Bushwick Bill has stage 4 pancreatic cancer. That's a big bummer. However, he's being strong. Bushwick is planning a tour later this year and working on a couple of albums, which we're hoping to see soon. Now, I cannot tell you what Bushwick's official website or Twitter account is. Otherwise, I'd direct you there for the latest info. There seems to be a bunch of different accounts. Can't tell which one is which. But needless to say, we do wish Bushwick well and would encourage listeners to donate what they can to their local cancer foundation. All right, and without further delay, here is the Vinyl Guide interview with Willie D, rap legend of the Geto Boys. Today, I am very excited. On the Vinyl Guide, we have world-famous rapper Willie D, best known for his time with the Geto Boys, but that's not all we're going to talk about today. Willie, how are you?
I'm splendid, man. I'm splendid. I can't complain. It ain't my style.
You always seem such a positive force, such a motivating guy. And I wasn't surprised to learn that early in your life you were a Golden Gloves boxer. Correct me if I'm wrong. It always seems you've had that mentality of that confidence in yourself. Would that be fair to say?
Well, I had to get confidence to survive. Growing up, I fought a lot. And, you know, I grew up in the hood, so oftentimes when you grow up in, like, impoverished communities, it's like a rat race, and it's a survival of the fittest. People who should be giving you guidance oftentimes don't give you guidance because they have their own struggles, and so they're self-absorbed. And oftentimes they lash out at people who they should be trying to train up the right way. So I'm 15 years old fighting grown men who are 30. Instead of them giving me game, instead of them seeing me and saying, hey, little boy, don't do that. And here's why you shouldn't do this instead. They, they looking at me like I'm competition. Like, you know, so if, you know, they're trying to, you know, date the same girls that I'm dating, that I'm trying to date. So they see me as competition. If I'm on the basketball court and there's an argument or whatever, they sit back, they want to see the fight happen instead of trying to defuse the situation. So oftentimes, you know, people just, you know, you're fighting at home and then you go out into the street and there's a fight. So there's no refuge, so you have to always have your game face on and be ready. So I was fighting so often that it was just a natural thing to do, to walk into a gym and fight, you know, and not be penalized for fighting. That was the first time that I ever had a fight and grown people actually congratulated me and I didn't get in trouble. Like, I was like, man, this is cool. I can do this. They gave me a trophy and everything. I won the fight. They They gave me a trophy. I was like, yeah, I can do this. You know, I can get used to this.
Something you would have gotten in trouble for elsewhere, you were celebrated for.
Yeah, man. Wow. Yeah.
So I guess that competitive edge stuck because at the same time you started rapping and then doing battle rapping. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. It was even the battle rap thing started with a competition thing. It was like on a dare, a friend. We used to hang out in the neighborhood and sing. You know, like if you can recall, like the Motown era when you used to see people out in on the street corners and all that type of stuff singing. We used to do that when we wasn't fighting. Mm-hmm. So a friend of mine was like, we were standing around listening to Run DMC one night. And a friend of mine named Steve Mayweather said, man, me and Willie can do that. I had never thought about rapping before. I was 15 years old, never had thought about rapping. And I was a fan of rap, but I never thought about actually becoming a rapper. So when he said that, everybody was like, yeah, right. You know, yeah, okay. So we took the challenge. He went into his house. I went into mine. And we both came out in an hour. He said his rap. Everybody started laughing at him. I said my rap. They started raising their eyebrows. And it was like that little push encouraged me. You know, it gave me confidence that, hey, you know, maybe, you know, I can do some more of this. Now, I'm still not thinking I want to rap now. It wasn't like I had this huge epiphany or anything. It's like, okay, that's cool, you know. I can write a little more because even though I didn't write, I used to write songs before I actually started writing raps. So I had a little poetry bug already. So when I started writing the rap, when I wrote the little rap part, people got excited. So I started battling guys in the neighborhood with that little 8-bar rap. And that's all I had. So when I would get to the end of it, I would be like, you know what, man? I ain't gonna even finish on you, fool. I got you. I'm not gonna even finish. Waste my time with you. And everybody go like, woo! You know, but I didn't have nothing else, so I had to try to break to a close, you know. So I worked that little angle for like weeks. I worked out with battle and worked that angle, and I said, you know what, I better go ahead and try to write some more stuff before they find me out. So that 8 bars turned into 16, the 16 turned into a song,
right.
And I just kept going from there.
Those early raps, did you keep any of those? Did you recirculate them on any of your early stuff?
I didn't, because even when I think back to those early raps, they were wickety, wickety whack. Like, just the pieces that I remember was just whack.
Do you remember?
Not a battle part.
Do you remember top of your head what they would? See if you could recite them.
I remember one time I told this dude, I said, I found out what this guy worked at. I used to battle against Romeo Poet. A guy named Romeo Poet is one of my good friends today. We used to battle every week. He was my nemesis. And I found out where he worked. And I said, he get on this stage and tell nothing but lies. Guess where he worked? At a damn Popeye. And the people hit the floor, man. They just lost it, you know? Then another time I found out that his girlfriend was pregnant. Mm-hmm. And I said, I know you think you're alive, you think your girlfriend deaf, but that baby she had ain't yours by yourself. And everybody, oh, people hit the floor like, and she had some enemies and stuff back then, so some of the girls didn't like her anyway. Mm-hmm. She was a really nice looking girl, but you know, so she had enemies, and man, people just lost it. But that worked for that time.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah. And so you started when you were 15. How long did it take you until you were working with James Prince over at Rap-A-Lot? You got signed originally as a solo artist, yeah?
Yeah. I got signed to Rap-A-Lot at 22.
Okay.
It was 88, yeah. 22. Okay.
You were signed as a solo artist, but then James also asked you to join the Ghetto Boys, who the album Making Trouble was already available at that time. Were you familiar with the Ghetto Boys already?
I was, and I was a fan of Assassins, the song Assassins. I didn't care too much for the other songs, but I liked Assassins. I thought that was like the most gritty gangster stuff ever written, man. So I was a fan of that song. When Jay asked me to write for the Ghetto Boys, the style was a little New Yorkish, you know? So he wanted me to bring that gangster shit, that Southern type, and tell our stories, like our real, like what really goes on in Houston, Texas, in the South. So that's when I came in. And I wrote Let a Ho Be a Ho and Do It Like a Geo. Those were the first two complete songs that I wrote for the Ghetto Boys. And so he started letting his friends and associates and business partners hear the song, and they were like really excited. So he was like, hey man, y'all either rap these songs or go solo. They were okay with Do It Like a Geo, but they didn't want to rap Let a Ho Be a Ho. So that's when Jay switched gears and asked me to actually join the group. And I was resistant at first because I just know I'm an odds person. I play odds. I study odds. And I like to do things when the odds are good, you know, in my favor. And I always had the impression that being in a group is not a good idea, because with so many conflicting personalities, even if it's just two people, now you have to do a lot of compromising, and you don't know how the next person is going to feel on any given day. You're ready to go on tour. They want to spend time with their family. You want to wear black in the video. They want to put on white. You know, you think that you should open up with this song. They want to stare at the audience and let the music play for 5 minutes, you know, like it's just, you know, it's a lot of compromise. I don't mind compromising. I'm a team player, but I've seen the best groups break up, you know? So I was like, I've seen the Temptations break up. The Jackson 5 broke up, you know, Rolling Stone broke up. You know, well, Police broke up.
You seem to be someone who, from the very beginning, has been not just having that confidence, but also successful as an individual. I mean, boxing is an individual art. Rapping, battle rapping is an individual art. You're not depending on other people. So all of a sudden, if you get into a group, you're depending on all sorts of other people for things that previously you just handled yourself. So I can see the complexity.
Yeah. That's a very good point. I don't mind, like, I guess growing up the way I did, I just didn't rely on other people. I knew that there were times that if I didn't go out and make something happen, I did not eat.
Yep.
My mama stopped cooking. When I was 15, my mom stopped cooking altogether. That might be some food in the house. It may not be. What you gonna do? So I learned early on but even before that, I started buying my own school clothes and buying my own hygienic products and all of that type of stuff when I was 10 years old. You know, I started cutting grass with my godfather, who was a Baptist minister. You know, he really taught me, you know, the value of an honest day's work for an honest day's pay. You know, he really instilled in me early on the value of good work ethics. So I did that. I cut grass between 10 years old to 18 in the summers and weekends with him. You know, I was always cognizant of the fact that I had to look out for myself because, you know, the people that were in charge, you know, of my life, basically in terms of, you know, my welfare, sometimes did not act appropriately. They did not complete their duties that time.
They can't give you what they don't have.
Yes, correct.
Yeah.
Can't give what you don't have.
So you join the Ghetto Boys, despite your initial resistance, and then you wrote most of the album Grip It on the Other Level. Is that fair, that you were the key writer for that album?
That is fair. You know, I won't say key writer. I can't say key writer because Brad contributed big time to that record. But, you know, I did write most of, I mean, it's three of us in the group. I wrote most of Bill's stuff.
Okay.
And I wrote all of my stuff.
When you have a song like, for instance, a topic, Gangster Love, would you then work with Brad and say, okay, here's kind of the direction we want to go. You go ahead and write your angle. I'll go ahead and write mine or Bill's or whatever like that. Would you kind of pick a topic and then split up and then come back? Or would you sit there and really work very closely with Brad on his contributions to the song?
No, we would normally, in the very beginning, especially like the first couple of albums, myself, Brad, and Jay would sit around and kind of like go over topics and stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. And then me and Brad would split off, and he'd go in one room, I'd go into the other room, and we write. Then we come back, and we hear yours. That's what I'm saying. Okay, that sounds good. Let's do another verse right here. Well, let's go back and forth right here. And then we'd come up with a song like that. When it came to Bushwick Bill, Bushwick Bill was not going to be in the Ghetto Boys at all. He was an honorary member of the Ghetto Boys in the beginning on the first album, the Making Trouble album. He was an honorary member because he was a dancer. He used to open up for the group, warm the crowd up before they came out and started rapping. Mm-hmm. So they thought it was a good idea to put him on the cover. And so that's why he's on the cover of the first album, Making Trouble.
Ah, so he was kind of the hype man initially. Yeah.
Yeah, he was a hype man. Yes. So when it came time to do the album with myself and Brad on it, Bill was just hanging out in the studio. I saw Bill drinking a 40 ounce one of the times that we had a little short break. Bill was hanging out in the studio drinking a 40 ounce of Old English. Mm-hmm. And between sips, he was rapping, yes, the rhythm, the rebel, without a pause, I'm lowering my level for the enemy. And a light came on. I said, man, what if we put Bushwick in the group? And everybody started laughing. I said, you see that? That's the reaction everybody else is going to have until they hear these gangsta-ass lyrics on the right form. When they first see them, they're going to be like, ah, ha, ha, midget. But then they're going to have respect because I'm going to write some dope-ass shit. So what happened is that I said, look, man, everybody started laughing, and because I am a practical joker from time to time.
Mm-hmm. They weren't sure if you were
everybody
serious.
Started, they wasn't sure, man. So they started laughing. Everybody started laughing, and Jay was, I said, no, nah, man, I'm serious. I said, no offense, Bushwick, but if I saw a midget rapping, I'd trip the fuck out. And especially if he was talking about some hood, some gangster shit. Talking about fucking hoes and all this type of shit. I'd trip out. You know? So, I ran the idea by Jay, and Jay was like scratching his head. He's like, I don't know, man. And I say, man, I say, if I write him something and he do it, if I write him something and he do it, he can deliver. Is he in the group? And Jay was like, I don't know, man. You know, let's see. You know, like, what you think, Bill? And Bill was like, I don't know, but I can try. So I took him downstairs. We were in the garage. You know, it was Jay had this a room above the garage, and we were in that room. It was a makeshift studio. So I took Bill into the house in the breakfast area, you know, where the breakfast table was. And I sat him there and I asked him some questions about what it was like to be a midget. And, well, Bill said dwarf. So what is it like to be? I asked what it was like to be a dwarf, you know. And he was like, you know, he was telling me that. And then he told me some of the things he had experienced and, you know, how he feel. And then I took that and I embellished it with what I thought it might be like to walk in his shoes, like what I would do if I was him. And I came up with side thing shit. So I wrote side thing shit in less than 45 minutes. After I wrote it, I brought it in and I let them hear it. I recorded it, and then John Beto coached them for 3 days, and Bill delivered signs and shit. That's how he became an official member of the Ghetto Boys. And that's how he became a rapper. That is how Bushwick Bill became a rapper. Any other story you hear is a bold-faced lie.
That's amazing. You may have missed your calling as a talent scout. So
yeah, I'm, you know what? I may have, but you know what? Maybe not. You know, I'm putting it out there right now. Any of you major record labels out there that want somebody that's experienced, that's got a good ear and a good eye for it, holler at your boy.
Cold
I'm available. You know what I'm saying? But bring the bag with you.
Absolutely. So the album Grip It on That Other Level comes out, and then Rick Rubin hears it and comes calling. Were you aware of Rick Rubin? What was the response of the band once you realized that he was interested in working with the Ghetto Boys?
First of all, hell yeah, I was aware of Rick Rubin. Mm-hmm. You know, you could not, you know, listen, man, I come up in a time where artists were serious about the people who came before them. You know, you don't just jump into, a genre of music or whatever and don't know the trailblazers. I knew all of them. So any major players, anybody who like was really, you know, involved heavily, I knew of them. So of course I knew of Rick Rubin. And when he came calling, I knew it was on, boy. I knew he was about to turn this motherfucker out. I was like, you know, yeah. So we were excited. Everybody was excited when Rick called, man. Mm-hmm. Everybody was excited. Rick was the one. It was Rick's idea to change the name of the group, you know, to change the spelling of the group.
Yeah, that's right. Because at that point, it had the H in it, Ghett.
Yeah. Yeah, that was Rick's idea, and it was also Rick's idea for me to be the lead member of the group. Mm-hmm. And we were all on the phone. You know, we were at that time a speaker phone and talking to Rick. We were all in the room, and Rick was like, very matter of fact, he was like, "And I want Willie. I think that's a good idea that Willie D be the lead member," and blah blah blah. So that's why, if you look up Ghetto Boys, you search Ghetto Boys, you'll see oftentimes where it says that I'm, you know, it'll mention me as the lead member of the Ghetto Boys, which is something that I actually have, you know, actually had a problem with out of the gate, because I really don't like having a group and somebody being called the leader, because it creates dissension. I think it always makes it seem like with you're the leader, what am I, the follower or something?
Right.
You know,
it creates an inequity in the group, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It does. You're right. Exactly. It creates inequity. And so for me, but I trusted Rick Rubin so much, I just went with it. See, I'm a team player, so you know, the role that I play on the team, it really don't matter. I mean, everybody wants to be a superstar and all that type of stuff, but I just want to be a winner. I just want to be on the winning team. So, you know, I can hit the winning shot, or I can pass the ball. I can make the free throw or the pass, or I can be on the sideline cheering and shit, you know, encouraging my team, you know, to get the job done. It don't matter to me. I just want to be a winner. I just want to be on the winning team, and I want to contribute. I don't want to be sitting on my ass and doing nothing. I want to make some kind of contribution, you know, whether, you know, I'm, like I said, inspiring my teammates from the sideline, or I'm in the game, you know, actually being one of the key components that makes the victory happen. Yeah, I want to win. So that's my stance with all of that, you know, that leadership shit. I've always had, leadership is one thing, but being, you know, I guess it kind of goes hands with, you know, but in hand in hand. But when you're in a group, you know, I think that's one of the things, like once you identify somebody as a leader, that's when people start going solo. And shit just started falling apart. But having said that, you know, I joined the Ghetto Boys with the intentions of going solo. I joined Ghetto Boys as a favor to Jay. So I never intended on being in the Ghetto Boys for 30 years.
The fact that you became the de facto leader or were called out as such at the time from Rick, did that create any issues right away? Or did those come later?
Not any that I noticed. See, I'm kind of stupid when it comes to like being a team member. So if we're on a team and unless you say I quit, I don't know that you're not playing team ball. You know, I don't know that you're not really thinking that we're a team, we're a unit. I don't know.
Yeah.
Until you tell me something, until you actually tell me something different. So if somebody makes a bad pass, or errant pass or whatever, I just kind of like chalk it up as he made a mistake. You know, this is not something that was done with malice, you know?
Yeah, you're trusting, you're doing your job, you're trusting everyone else is doing their job and holding up their end. So,
exactly.
How many meetings did you have with Rick? Like, how long did it take it to happen to where you went from that initial phone call to starting to re-record parts of the album?
Shit. Seemed like a day, because we talked to him one day, and we went into the studio like the next couple days or so, and man, we knocked those songs out. I mean, we worked fast back then, man. It wasn't all of those hangups. I guess also because people didn't have as many obligations and kids and all of that type of stuff. Some of us had no kids. I didn't have kids. Brad had no kids. Bill had no kids. Mm-hmm. You know, so Red had no kids. So none of the key members, you know, had the members, period, had kids. So we didn't have kids. I think none of us had wives.
The Ghetto Boys was life, I mean, at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. So we didn't have, our obligation was to the Ghetto Boys. So it was easy to go in the first album. We completed our first album, the Grip It On That Other Level album, in 10 days. Mm-hmm. As far as the recording, the writing and recording, we wrote and recorded that album in 10 days.
So did Rick come to Houston? Did you guys go to LA? How did you work together?
I never saw Rick like in Houston. Like, I don't remember ever meeting Rick in Houston. Okay. Yeah, I never met Rick actually
In fact, I don't know if I've ever actually met Rick in person.
Oh, this is all done remotely.
Yep.
So you guys did some re-recording and just sent the tapes to Rick wherever he's at, L.A. or New York or wherever.
Yep.
And he.
Yep.
Okay. Now, all the music that was created, now the Geto Boys, especially that period of the Geto Boys, is really known for that gritty, raw, those beats, those samples, all that stuff. Is that pretty much kind of the hands of Reddy Red that made the record sound that way?
Reddy Red. Period. You can give John Beto some credit also, but it was Reddy Red that did the heavy load. You know, he carried the heavy equipment.
Any insight into his style and how he got those sounds? Because again, those two albums right there are just sonically, you could pick them out of anywhere. They sound phenomenal unique.
I can tell you, mm-hmm. Reddy Red was an unconventional sound man. Like, a sound was a sound to him. Mm-hmm. Like, if it was a sound, it was music in his ears. So when he heard a soundtrack, he was one of the first persons, if not the first person in hip hop, to sample a movie. Mm-hmm. You know, or to sample Scarface. I know for a fact he was the first to sample Scarface, the movie Scarface. So Red was sampling anything. He sampled a movie. He sampled, you know, a broomstick sweeping. Just any sound, he'd sample it, like live sounds. You know, like he'd get those sounds and just sample them. So you'd hear all kind of quirky things happening in his music, and you'd also hear a lot of transitioning. That was done on purpose because we didn't want to. That's something that we talked about because we didn't want to bore the audience. So if you notice on that first album, you didn't hear a lot of transitioning, but you know, the Making Trouble album, but when it became him, me, Brad and Bill, you hear a lot of transitioning and stuff. And that's something me and him actually had a conversation about. I told him that we need to keep it interesting and switch it up, keep switching it up. So you hear a lot of transitioning in those early albums.
The Grip It on the Other Level has a lot in common with that Rick Rubin album, the Deaf American album. And then there are a few new tracks. Fuck 'em, City Under Siege, I think one or two more. Were those songs already written and planned for the next album?
No. We never had pre-recorded records sitting around. Mm-hmm. We made records, and when we make a record, it's going on the album. Mm-hmm. We've never had leftover records until the last album in 2005. That's some leftover stuff from 2005 that's incomplete, mm-hmm. like maybe like have two verses on it, and you know, maybe one song that's complete and one or two songs that's finished, but. You know, when we make a record, it goes on the album.
Right.
So that's not a, that won't be any like treasure trove of,
there's no box
Geto
set.
Boy records found later down the line,
right.
You know, in our demise or whatever, as we get older and all that, you're not going to find all of that. Okay. That's not going to be the case with Geto Boy.
Going back to Reddy Red and his style, one question I always have is around the samples of Gangster Love. Now, on the Grip It album, they used the Gangster Boogie hook.
Mm-hmm.
But then the early pressings of the Rick Rubin album had the Steve Miller Gangster Love on it. What was
that's because that motherfucker Steve Miller funky ass sued us, man. That motherfucker sued us. That son of a bitch. No, I'm just bullshitting. I'm bullshitting. he did threaten to sue, but I can't blame him. Shit, we use this music without permission. So, but here, okay, let me explain how this went. Okay, so Steve Miller is like, a god in music, right? Okay, Steve Miller. So it's like that damn Joker was jamming so hard. Reddy Red let me hear the sample.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, ooh, this shit is jamming. And it was already jamming. And I was like, Red,
Leave it alone. And he was like, well, you know, let me finish, man. You know, I got some stuff I want to put in here, man. And if it works, you know, we can use it. If it don't, cool. So that's when Red, so he started it off when he had the sample grooving. He had it, coming against the love. Mm-hmm. So it started with that. He started playing around with that. Then he put the beat on it. And then I was cool with that. But then he was like, he added that little shit right there, man. That little bass line right there, it just kept it funky, kept it grooving.
Oh yeah.
You know? And so one of the keys, I can tell you the secret to Ghetto Boy music, and can't nobody redo it no way, so it doesn't matter. Red is dead, you know? Mm-hmm. So it can't be redone. Even after Red died, really, you know, it was all, our music is always the music that talks to you. Listen to the music, and the music has a mind of its own. The music is like talking to you. Listen to Gangsta Love. Doom, doom, doo, 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 doo. It's like the music, like, I got a voice, man, let me talk. You know, the music is talking to you. Listen to Steel. Yeah, you know, listen to, boom, 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 boom. You know, listen to Mind Playing Tricks, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Listen to,
it's like the music is the fifth member of the Ghetto Boys.
Oh, man. God damn it, man. Look, I need to hire you as a PR agent. That was good. That was good. Boy, that boy was going to be somebody. That was good. That was some good shit. Oh, man, you got away with words. I see why you're German. You got away with words.
you're painting the picture. I'm just interpreting it.
Yeah, goddamn, you need to go and get hired by the. I was about to say get hired by Congress. The government to do some interpretations and to do some interpreting. You know, for government officials. But shit, you might get shut down and. They might end up owing you money. You might have to quit. You know.
Let me tell you, yeah, working for the government, you're not getting a paycheck these days. So, yeah.
That might not be a good look.
So let me ask you this: so Gangster Love, it started with the version on Grip It, then it went to the version with Steve Miller, and then Steve Miller said no, and then you guys went back to the version with what, Lynyrd Skynyrd and the Gangsta Boogie.
Hook. Yeah.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Because you know Steve Miller got paid. I'm like, well, if you're gonna take the damn song, let us at least keep using it. But he got paid for, you know, the time he did use it. You know, we had to stroke him a nice little check.
Yeah.
You know? But it was all good because Gangsta Love is one of our best songs. I mean, to this day, it's one of the fan favorites. So, you know, we've gotten that money back, you know, 100 times, 1,000 times over.
Yeah. Great story out of it, too. So, now, when the Ghetto Boys album was getting ready to drop, there was a big controversy with David Geffen. Correct me if I'm wrong here, but David Geffen heard the album, did not want to distribute it. And on top of that, the CD manufacturing company that was owned by Sony, they refused to have anything to do with it. So that
first time in history.
That's unprecedented.
First time in history that a pressing plant refused to actually manufacture a record based on its content.
That's amazing. So when you guys heard word of that, and to his credit, Rick stuck by you and was loyal to you guys to the point that he changed his distribution, yeah, his whole model from Geffen to Warner.
When I heard about it, I grabbed a pen and I said,
Let's talk about a scandal. The album Geffen Found Too Hot to Handle fucked up the minds of you and yours. The last LP from the Ghetto Boys. Can you believe those hypocrites would distribute guns and roses, but not our shit? And they say we're racist act. Ain't that the pot calling the kettle black? Man, fuck them hoes. We got new partners and got shit done regardless. Cause our fans are ever ready down to die hard around the globe to fifth ward. I heard a news report. Some lawyer in Florida want to take us to court. Somebody tell that country ass hit to go suck a dead man's dick. You scream obscenity, but it's publicity you won't host, so don't act like you don't know. Better fuck with somebody else before you get popped, because we can't be stopped. That's what I said. That's what I wrote.
And that was the fuel for the next album. So we can't be stopped.
When that happened, I wrote that We Can't Be Stopped song, and we all agreed that we'd make that the title of the album.
Why wasn't We Can't Be Stopped on Deaf American? Did you have any conversations with Rick Rubin about working with him again?
I never had a conversation with Rick Rubin other than the first conversation that we had when he expressed interest that he wanted to work with Ghetto Boys and, you know, move forward like that. Now, the reason why, from what I understand, I was not really involved in the business at all back in those days. I didn't care to be involved in the business. I wanted to just get in my lane as an artist and do what I'm supposed to do as an artist. So I was not involved in the day-to-day discussions about business and stuff like that. All I knew is that Jay told me that the record was not going to be, that he was not doing business with Rick anymore. And he had switched gears and got a deal with Priority. He told me it was going to be on Priority. So, and that's why We Can't Be Stopped was on Priority. He liked what Priority was over there doing for NWA and Ice Cube. So, you know, we made the switch.
Now, a question on... what is a legendary album cover here? We Can't Be Stopped. Apparently, Bushwick was in the hospital. He'd just been shot in the eye with a gun. But apparently, the band had the wherewithal to shoot the album cover while he was in the hospital. Did you get a last-minute phone call, something like, you know, can you come over to the hospital and wear your good clothes? We're going to shoot the album cover. What was that like? No?
Nope. That the whole album cover thing was impromptu. We had the stuff that we had on was the stuff we were wearing already. Everybody had on what they were wearing that day. Mm-hmm. So when I got the call, like everybody else, we all went to Bentov Hospital in Houston. Okay, we heard Bill got shot. My first reaction, like most people's first reaction, I think, was that my band member, my brother, has been shot. I hope he's okay. First thing is I'm thinking is that, you know, I'm praying, I'm hoping that he's okay. Mm-hmm. So I go to the hospital worried, not knowing what condition I'll find him in when I get there. I get there, I walk in, and he's laying on the gurney, and he's dazed. But he's alive and his eye is gone, but he's alive. And he's speaking to me, you know, I'm like, Bill, you know, like, you are, yeah, it's Will, you know, you okay? Yeah, well, it was all my fault. Please don't hurt her. He was like talking about Kamika, you know, the girlfriend.
Yep.
Who shot him? He was like, it was my fault. Please don't hurt her. Please don't hurt her. So when that happened, so as time ticks, more people are coming to the hospital. Now the group is there. Myself and Brad is at the hospital. Cliff, who was Jay's partner at the time, was at the hospital. And Cliff says,
okay, man, what are y'all going to do about the album cover? I said, he said, what you mean? Because the album was finished. Mm-hmm. We had just finished recording the album. He said, what are you going to do? You know, we got to put the record out. You know, I think he said, like, we have to put the record out in a month. Man. What are we going to do about the album cover? I said, well, shit. He's alive. Let's shoot it right now. Let's shoot it right now. So Cliff, like, eyes got really big, like, you know me right here? Like, I mean, how you gonna do that? I say, who's gonna ask Bill? I said, I'll ask him. I went upstairs to Bill's room and I stood next to him and I said, and I shook him awake, Bill. Hey, yo, I said, Bill, look, we got to shoot this album cover. You down? And Bill said, yeah. So I went back downstairs. I told Cliff. He said he want to do it.
Go get your camera.
Cliff went to his car, got his camera. me and Brad went upstairs, and we asked the nurse for a gurney. The nurse gave us a gurney. We rolled Bill out into the hallway. And Cliff snapped that picture. And that's how you got that album cover. Now, a lot of people down the line, because Bill had expressed regret that he was taken advantage of in a time of weakness. And he was in a bad shape, and it was a really private moment, and we shouldn't have never taken the picture, and it shouldn't have never been on the album cover. And so there were some people having some, because he had reservations about it, there were some people who thought that that was like some type of really, really cruel thing for us to do. In retrospect, would I have done it? You goddamn right I would have done it again. Hell yeah, I'd do it again. Listen, Nate. The album was called We Can't Be Stopped. How the fuck you gonna call your... How you gonna name an album We Can't Be Stopped? And then let a gunshot stop you. You know what I'm saying? Like, if you're alive, you take the picture. I don't care if it was me. If I'm alive, I take the picture. That's me. I'm just built like that. That's the way I'm built. I mean, maybe that's too much for some people, but that's the way I'm built. I'm like, let's get it done. I'm a doer. I'm not a person that try to... If somebody comes to me with any type of idea to build, to do something, I am going to think about how I can get it done. I'm going to think of all the reasons why it can be done, not why it can't be done. So my first thought, once I knew Bill was okay, that he was going to live, life goes on, man. We still got to make this record. This record has to come out. We got to feed our families. You know, not making that record, not putting the record out is not helping anybody. Don't help anybody. Now, Bill didn't really express reservations about the album cover until years later. I never heard Bill complain about the album cover. Even immediately after he got out and he was okay, like back and had all of his faculties together, I never heard him complain about the record. I didn't hear Bill complain about that cover until years later. So I don't know where that came from. Mm-hmm. But I know that we all benefited from that cover, and so did he. All of our families also, our families benefited from it. The fans benefited from it. The only negative
aspect that I can possibly think of is that he has to look at his eye, you know, like out all the time. But hell, his eye is out right now. You know what I'm saying? He's looking in the mirror. You can see, you know, he look in the mirror and, you know, his eye looks better. You know, even though it's out, it looks better than it did when he was, you know, it looks better from the album covers at times than it do now. So, I don't know, man.
Well, look, that's absolutely the right decision. Because, look, a couple of things. Number one, he went way into detail into that whole process, what led him up to that in a song. So that's fully described. But also, we're talking about that album cover some 30 years later, you know?
Yeah.
It's a legendary album cover. No one else is talking about album covers from 1991 anywhere. You know, this is one that stands aside. So I'm on Team Willie on this one. Definitely. Solid. So
there you go, man. I need to stack the deck. If you got any other friends that want to jump on the team, let me, at this moment, right now in time, I do deputize you to deputize them on the spot.
I believe just about everyone will be on Team Willie. I'll deputize them. I think the only ones that I'll have a tough time with are the optometrists.
Right. We'll have to...
So, Willie, you've had a very, and I don't mean to just focus only on the Geto Boys career in this era of the Geto Boys, but this seems to be the most legendary. And certainly the albums that I listened to in my youth and are highly, highly collectible out there. I don't know if you know, but some of the Geto Boys records, they go for hundreds of dollars out there on the in the collector's markets. So you've also got a lot of solo albums as well. Play With Your Mama is one of my favorites. Going Out Like a Soldier, those albums are out there as well on Rap-A-Lot and a few other labels. What are you up to these days?
These days, I am spending a lot of time building my media company. You know, I'm doing some things on the internet, you know, where I'm going to be giving new internet entrepreneurs an opportunity to launch their own platforms, because I got a pretty solid platform, solid presence on YouTube and Instagram and Facebook. And so I'm going to be giving new entrepreneurs and host a lane so that they can do their thing. But also, I just started a luxury car rental business. So I rent out Mercedes-Benzes and BMWs and Maseratis and Rolls Royces and all that kind of stuff. And I'm actually getting ready to get back into real estate. I used to do real estate back in the 90s, and I laid off of it, but I'm coming back to it. So I'm doing that. I got my hand in a lot of things.
Yeah. Now, I want to encourage people to check out WillieD.com. Willie's got a new song and a video. I don't even think I could say the name, but maybe it'd be best, Willie, if you set this one up.
Yeah, well, the name of the song rhymes with boom.
Well, you can say it.
Doom.
You can say it. I can't say it.
Loom. I just can't bring myself to say the word coon, man. I just can't say the word, man. Y'all call it what you want to call it, but go out there, check it out. Now, it is important that people, but here's the deal. It's important. I think you can say it. It's important that people know that coon is interchangeable. It's race interchangeable. It doesn't matter what race or ethnicity, background or whatever. Coon is just a person who would sell out, you know, their people. It's a person, you know, who would, who would sell out their people for, especially a person who would sell out their people for profit, you know, throw their community under the bus for their own self-advancement. Somebody whose criticism of their community outweighs their contribution. That's a coon. So, historically, people have used the term to refer to, white people in America has used the term to refer to, well, some white people in America has used the term to refer to black people. But, coon, like a lot of other words, it can apply to anybody, shoe fit, wear it. Mm-hmm.
The video and the song is very self-explanatory and lays out your thoughts on that. And it's available at willied.com. Again, I encourage people to go check it out. And Willie, thank you so much for joining us here on The Vinyl Guide and sharing those stories. I'm very honored you were on the show. I've been listening to you for some 30, 35 years and really appreciate getting some of the thoughts and some of the behind the scenes of what was happening on some of these albums that that all of us love so much. I want to encourage people to check out willied.com. He's got a new song, a new video up there. Check that out, as well as follow Willie on Instagram and YouTube at willied. Live. And Willie, anytime you have anything you want to promote, you come back here, especially if it's a vinyl record. We'll be happy to have you on The Vinyl Guide anytime, man.
You got it. And to your fans, give yourself a round of applause, because you're following Nate to get it straight out the gate. You did. No more talk.
Excellent. Thank you so much. All right, there we go. Willie D of the Ghetto Boys. That was one of my top gets. I got to tell you, top interview gets. When I started out this podcast, I always thought to myself, I want to get one of the Ghetto Boys here on the show. And guess what? I got Willie D. And I'm so stoked about it. I hope you guys enjoyed that conversation. And by the way, if you have Instagram, make sure to follow Willie D Live. It's very entertaining. He goes live at least like once a day. I'm always seeing him go live. And he just talks and pontificates and gives his opinion on the news of the day. It's really worth following Willie D Live at Instagram. Alrighty, well, that's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Hey, do me a favor, make sure you leave a positive review on iTunes, will ya? Head over to Apple, press the button that says leave a review, and give me 5 stars, say something nice. You know, the better the reviews, the better the feedback, the more it kind of goes up the charts and gets better exposure. So if you want to do something for your buddy Nate, something nice, go over to Apple or Android, wherever you can, leave a positive review for the Vinyl Guide podcast. Much appreciated. And we should be back next week with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram at Vinyl Guide. Until next time, keep spinning.